This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
From Hester Prynne's Scarlet Letter to pillories in the town square, public shaming has deep roots in America and is hardly a thing of the past. How is humiliation experienced in the 21st century? Well, that's what we're exploring this hour. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. And today's show is all about shame and how it affects all of us, the shamers and the shamed, like Maggie Baumer. In 2012, Maggie's future looked bright. Fresh out of law school, she was living in Manhattan and practicing as an associate attorney at a prominent immigration firm in the city. Having started her career as a mental health counselor on a psychiatric ward, she was thriving in her new field as a lawyer. And like many young professionals, she looked forward to letting loose after a stressful week at work. And that's just what she was doing on October 27th, 2012.
So that was a Friday night right near Halloween, and I had been out at a Halloween party with some friends, and a friend of mine had been visiting from out of town, so I had given her my keys, and we'd kind of parted ways at some point in the evening, and so I forgot to get my keys back from her. So when I got back to my apartment, I was locked out. So I was trying to figure out a way to get into my apartment and kind of made an unwise decision to slide down the trash chute there.
Maggie lived in a first floor apartment with windows that looked out onto a courtyard. So her plan was to slide down the trash chute into the basement. From there, she'd walk up the stairs into the courtyard and crawl in through her window.
So that was my line of thinking, not the best decision, obviously. I was definitely, my judgment was impaired, and, you know, I'd been drinking, and that's certainly part of the story. And but, you know, another part of it is just I'm sort of an adventurous, independent person, and so I was kind of like, I'll figure this out. I'll get into my place somehow, some way.
Maggie looked into the chute and could see clear down to the light in the basement, or so she thought. So as a friend looked on, she climbed in and slid down.
It turned out that there was actually a trash compactor in there, hidden from view. And so what happened was I slid down and was kind of turning myself around to go out feet first. And as I did that, my left arm just went into this empty space that I couldn't see and suddenly realized that something was locked down on my arm and I couldn't get it out.
Maggie, unable to free her arm, called up in a panic to her friend, who dialed 911.
Eventually, fire department came and they were able to extract me, but it took a long time. And when I did finally pull my arm out, you know, it was literally hanging off by a thread from, you know, from the elbow point. I looked down and could just kind of see, like, this bloody stump of an arm. Oh. So, as you can imagine, that was a very traumatic thing to look at and see on yourself.
Maggie Baumer was rushed to Bellevue Hospital, where she underwent an 8-hour surgery to reattach her arm. 2 days later, Superstorm Sandy hit. Bellevue was put on a backup generator, and patients were evacuated. Maggie was sent 2.5 miles uptown to Weill Cornell Medical College. Her family, who had traveled to the city to be with her, was stranded in Brooklyn and unable to see her. A week later, she underwent a second surgery to reconstruct her elbow. As Maggie endured all of this, something else was percolating. The day after her accident, the New York Post carried the story with the headline, "Drunk Lawyer Crushes Her Arm Trying to Get Into Her Chelsea Apartment."
Boy, was she trashed. A completely hammered Manhattan lawyer who got locked out of her Chelsea apartment yesterday nearly lost her arm when she jumped down the garbage chute to get back inside. The harebrained bid began when attorney Maggie Baumer came home from a long night on the town at around 6 a.m., only to find herself stuck without keys to her first-floor apartment on West 21st Street.
Maggie's story and her full name and job title and picture made their way to the New York Daily News, the Business Insider, and the media blog Gawker. The legal industry blog Above the Law ran with the headline, "A Recent Cardozo Law Grad Gets Trashed, Literally." The story got picked up internationally and found its way into the Daily Mail UK, all before Maggie was even out of the hospital.
I'd kind of had in the back of my mind that there was probably a story about it. At one point, I wanted to look at my Facebook page, and my friend who was visiting me was like, "Why don't you let me look at it for you and, like, read you things, you know?" And so I kind of got the sense, like, oh, okay, like, this is a public thing now. But honestly, I was kind of protecting myself because I didn't really want to know right away about that. On the last day I was at Weill Cornell, the day I got discharged, I finally, as we were getting ready to leave, I finally asked my family, like, what, like, if there had been a story, and they said yes. They told me it was in the New York Post, and I think at that point it might have not, there were a couple other little blogs that had picked it up, but it hadn't gone as viral as it would eventually get. But yeah, that was really horrifying, and, you know, I cried, of course, and was really upset about it, and I was sent home back to Massachusetts to recover, and, you know, it was something that was always hanging over me, but I was focused on other things.
Namely, the recovery of her hand. After more hospital visits and several limb salvage surgeries, Maggie's vein clotted and her hand became necrotic. A month after the accident, Maggie's hand, wrist, and lower forearm were amputated. And as she recovered and set about adjusting to her new physical reality, the weight of the tabloid stories came down on her.
You know, several months down the line, once I was recovering and, you know, out of the woods in terms of severe trauma, it was something that really affected me and made me very upset.
Well, Maggie, that you said before this went viral, you know, why do you think the story was picked up by the tabloids?
Yeah, I mean, several reasons. One is it's pretty sensational. You know, it's not like a story that you hear every day. Like, certainly my action wasn't typical. Also, part of it, I think, is the fact that I'm a lawyer, so there's some kind of status level, I guess, that people attribute to being an attorney, and there's also an interest level that somehow lawyers' private lives are not private to the same level as other people. And also, I think part of it is that I'm female, and that was kind of an angle that the media played on as well.
How so?
So I haven't read through all the comments that people have made, but I've been told that, you know, some of it was trying to paint this picture of me as some socialite, stupid woman who, you know, did this thing, and playing into stereotypes of like, blonde, female, whatever.
Did those hit home for you? I mean, like, what did that make you feel? I'm curious.
Awful. That made me feel terrible. Mm-hmm. Just because I think, you know, in certain ways, that's something I've been working against my whole life, is wanting to be seen as intelligent and, you know, being seen for your full character rather than, like, certain traits about you. I think we all work against traits about ourselves all the time. And so this is sort of my worst nightmare come true, is to have this public questioning of my intelligence and, you know, the picture they chose to put up of me was, like, you know, not the picture from my firm's website of me in a business suit. It was a picture from Facebook that I thought was private of me in a tube dress on vacation. And so you can't really see, it's not a full body shot. So it sort of looks like I'm naked and I'm kind of making a facetious face at my friend who is taking the picture. So it's like a very purposeful choice in photos, I think. And, you know, the whole angle of the story is to be like, look what a stupid person this person was. I can't believe she did this. And to kind of highlight somebody's worst moment and laugh at it, especially when, you know, some of those articles say in there, they talk about how my arm was hanging off by a thread. I don't understand how you could read that sentence and then also laugh. Like, you know, that was a really traumatic, horrible thing. My family and I, my friends are at, and I are, like, going through that. None of that is funny. None of it is humorous.
It's been 2.5 years since Maggie's accident, and while her story is just one snide drop into the tabloid bucket, the incident changed her life in dramatic and profound ways. Her physical recovery is now complete, and she's awaiting a new prosthesis, which should be arriving any day now. She left the law firm she was working for in New York, and after a year of recuperating at home, decided to stay there.
And so now I live back in my hometown in Northampton, Massachusetts, which I love. And I'm working for a prosthetic company now, and I do a lot of community work in terms of offering peer support and mentorship to other amputees. And I've also become really involved with an organization called Women's Voices Worldwide. And our mission is to educate women and girls to be strong speakers and empowered speakers in all aspects of their lives. You know, this incident and event and trauma actually gave me a lot of opportunities to kind of explore what I wanted to do and how to use my voice and how to heal and move forward. And I'm feeling much better, obviously, too, about the whole humiliation of me publicly, although, you know, it's painful to know that it's still present on the web and that there's not really much I can do about that. Although my kind of solace in that is knowing that it mostly makes the people who wrote it and commented on it look poor. I mean, obviously it doesn't paint me well either, but I have to say that, you know, whoever has decided to write these things, it's a poor decision on their part too, because that's also out there on the web for everyone to see, and poor PR.
While Maggie's story may be painful to hear, it's all too familiar in the digital age, when what was once a silly slip-up or tawdry tale whispered among townsfolk can be spread across the world with lightning speed. Cultural anthropologists consider shame and the attendant threat of ostracism as tools societies use for educating children and maintaining order. But who needs the stockade or public shunning when we have Twitter? John Ronson profiles victims, perpetrators, and researchers of humiliation in his new book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. And John Ronson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
Well, I'd like to start with Jonah Lehrer, because he was a guest on our very first Word of Mouth program, a young hotshot pop science writer in the Malcolm Gladwell mode, who resigned from The New Yorker in shame. Remind us, please, of how it was discovered that he'd made up quotes and attributed them to Bob Dylan.
Right. So Michael Moynihan, who's a journalist and a blogger, just happened to notice that there were these quotes in chapter one of Jonah's last book called Imagine, these Bob Dylan quotes that just didn't sound like Bob Dylan. You know, we all know how kind of spiky and arch and kind of, you know, Bob Dylan was. And yet the quotes in Jonah's book, you know, made Bob Dylan actually kind of sound a little bit like Joan Alera. and also there were famous quotes like, Bob Dylan says in the movie Don't Look Back, when he's reading an article about himself and how he smokes 80 a day, Bob Dylan says, "Wow, I'm glad I'm not me." Mm. And in Joan Alera's book, the quote was, "I'm glad I'm not me, I'm glad I'm not that."
Mm.
So Michael realised that Jonah had been kind of manipulating Bob Dylan quotes, you know, for his own ends. So he emailed Jonah, and Jonah made the most human but terrible mistake of basically saying to Michael, no, you know, my quotes are correct. It's history that's wrong. Mm. You know, I went back to it. So he panicked and dug himself in deeper. And for a smart man, everything Jonah did was really stupid. But, you know, human.
I think all of us can understand that. You know, you make a big mistake and try to cover it up. And meanwhile, Joan Alera at this time is a fancy writer living in a fancy mid-century modern home in L.A. and exposed by the kind of person, a man who described himself as a schlub to you several times, who used to be powerless. This seems to me like the kind of wonderful/horrible thing about Twitter.
Mm. You know, I said to Twitter when I was writing my book, something has happened, I think. I can't remember exactly, but there was some public shaming. I mean, my God, there's been so many. And I said, are we becoming a kangaroo court? And somebody wrote back, not a kangaroo court, just commentary, only unlike you, John, we're not getting paid for it.
Huh.
So the worst transgression on Twitter, and this is, you know, the worst, you know, the most shameworthy thing nowadays in our society is people who misuse privilege. Jonah misused privilege. That's what people have got for these days. And of course, it's better. You know, that's a better target than somebody involved in some kind of consensual sex scandal. You know, back in Puritan times, you'd get whipped for having an affair. You know, these days you get destroyed for misusing your privilege. Mm. But, and so, of course, you know, we can support that more. But the problem is that we've so fallen in love with attacking people who've misused their privilege that we now attack people who kind of aren't privileged and haven't really done anything wrong.
Well, at least that was the case with Justine Sacco. Remind us of Justine Sacco, a young publicist on her way to a flight from New York City to Cape Town. What happened with her?
So she stops off at Heathrow and writes, you know, trying to be like Colbert, writes, going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white.
Hmm.
So, you know, she was following in the tradition of, you know, Randy Newman has written plenty of songs along those lines, lots of episodes of South Park, you know, Colbert. The difference between Justine and those people was that she wasn't good at it.
Hmm.
So she didn't get any replies, which didn't surprise her because she only had 170 Twitter followers and she never got any replies. She still felt that kind of sadness that we all feel when the internet doesn't congratulate us for being funny. And then got on the plane and turned off her phone and slept and then woke up 10 hours later, turned on her phone and a text came up from somebody she hadn't spoken to since high school that said, I am so sorry to see what's happening to you. And then her phone just exploded, and, you know, with texts and alerts. And her best friend said, you need to phone me right away. You are the worldwide number one trending topic on Twitter.
And she became instantly infamous, landed in South Africa. There was a photographer there waiting for her, just enveloped in shame. And what happened to her? She didn't just lose her job. She lost her vocation. She had to move out of New York.
Yeah, she lost her sense of self. You know, when I met her a couple of weeks later, she was saying, you know, I've forgotten who I am. You know, I wake up in the middle of the night forgetting who I am. I'm losing myself. I mean, these are things that people with PTSD say. And really, she was crushed. And things only started to get better for Justine after a year. She was cast out into the wilderness for a year. And then, you know, my book came along and it was extracted in the New York Times. And that's when things started to get better for her.
Well, I'm actually wondering about the efficacy of shaming, if it actually helps people redeem themselves. I mean, you looked at this from a couple of different perspectives. You went back historically to the American colonial era of the pillory and the public humiliation. And to Judge Ted Poe, this is Texas judge who does those, you know, sentenced people to, for instance, walk down the highway with a sign that says, I was driving drunk and killed two people for 6 months or something like that.
Yeah, I found my Ted Poe meeting so interesting because, you know, I felt like I think most people would feel, you know, this guy, he's a friend of Bush. He's this big, loud lawmaker. We kind of don't like him. So I went to see him sort of thinking that. And then I realized, speaking to the people who he had sentenced to walk up and down the road wearing those placards, they would say to me, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because people would stop their cars and they would say, you know, oh, I'm so sorry. Come with me to church. Things will be okay. When Justine Sacco was being destroyed on Twitter, nobody said things will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
No one was supporting her. In real life, we're really nice. And, you know, it was those people saying those empathetic things to that guy who'd killed two people while driving drunk that changed his life. It wasn't the punishment that changed his life. It was the empathy.
I wonder if the nature of shaming will also change, or the notion, rather, of shaming, when everybody's lives are going to be on the internet, you know, and they will have been for a long time. So you could no longer say, I didn't inhale. You know, it's probably on somebody's video somewhere.
Yeah.
Is the notion of shame going to change? Is it going to... We've leveled the playing field, in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, you would hope, you know. I mean, obviously, we're living in a time now where everyone's going to be unelectable.
Because
not only unelectable, but nobody can be the next Daily Show host because of something that happened in their past. So, yeah, you would think it's going to have to change. You know, when somebody has been shamed, they find it almost impossible because they can understand the agony of it, and it's agony. And I think once people do that, it's really hard to go back and shame other people. So maybe when everybody has been shamed, it's going to burn itself out because you can't do it to other people when it's been done to you because you know the reality of what it feels like.
Well, John Ronson, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
John Ronson's new book is So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and he's also the author of The Men Who Stare at Goats and The Psychopath Test. Up next, disgrace as deterrent. Word of Mouth talks to the AG of Utah, which recently initiated a groundbreaking policy to combat consumer fraud, a public registry for white-collar criminals. Shaming the shameless when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and today's show is all about the invisible force that is shame. The stockade, the pillory, tarring and feathering. Throughout history, the threat of public punishment was a means of establishing communal norms and expectations. As cultures matured, those sometimes arbitrary rules became codified into laws and systems of criminal justice. Well, as we're hearing today, shame is alive and well and covers a lot more ground more quickly than it used to. But is it a deterrent? The state of Utah hopes so. In March, Utah's legislature established the first white-collar crime offender registry in the country. The goal is to expose consumer fraudsters by publicly posting their names, offenses, and photos, which critics say is aimed more at old-world shaming than at prevention. Sean Reyes is Attorney General for the state of Utah and among those who spearheaded the measure. I recently spoke with him and asked which crimes make someone eligible for the white-collar registry.
They have to be second-degree felonies or higher. So securities fraud, mortgage and insurance fraud, theft by deception, those are the categories of crimes, and the severity would be second-degree felonies or higher. We're not interested in listing everyone who's ever had some brush up with a financial crime, but trying to focus on those that we believe would be the greatest threat. You know, one of the main purposes, in addition to providing information, is to incentivize restitution or repayment of money that's defrauded from victims. They rarely get anything in return. Some estimates are 0.5%, but so many of the cases that I've seen or that I've done, they get nothing. And then lastly, to deter offenders from committing crimes or reoffending, the rate of recidivism or reoffense for these types of crimes is so extremely high, and the effects are incredibly devastating. Countless lives are ruined every year, not just in our state, but nationwide. Many of the victims are senior citizens.
Mm-hmm.
They happen to be also very trusting in nature. Handshakes for them are often a good enough due diligence for a deal, or they feel confident with just no paperwork, and they end up investing and losing their life savings. And it's interesting to me, Virginia, people will often do an incredible amount of due diligence looking online and reading consumer reports before they buy a blender or a laptop computer, but they'll sign away their entire life savings because somebody has a can't-miss deal. This is only for you. We'll triple your money back in a short amount of time. And then they're left with no resources to take care of an aged or ill spouse or just the quality of life that they had hoped for. So, you know, we did a lot of research with a number of experts, social scientists, prosecutors, defense lawyers, to try to calibrate a way to protect citizens, help incentivize restitution, because
Can you pick that up for me? I'm really interested in knowing about this restitution. I mean, I have those parents, you know, who saved up all of their money all of their life and have nearly fallen for scams. So I believe there is a special place in Hades, let's say, for people who scam the elderly. But how does the registry help compensate people who've been defrauded?
Excellent question. So the perpetrators who've made restitution can keep from being on the registry. That comes into play both on the front end when they're negotiating a plea deal, for instance, with prosecutors, and they could plea down to a third degree felony and stay off of the registry, or even if they're on the registry and they either make full restitution after the fact or they start to make positive steps towards restitution, we have the ability, the discretion to take them off of the registry. So it's a tool both on the front end and on the back end. Truly, victims don't care as much about how long perpetrators stay incarcerated or in prison. They just want their money back.
And I understand that for a lot of elderly people especially, they are so ashamed about being swindled that often they don't come forward.
That's another dynamic that comes into play. People are very embarrassed. They're ashamed. They don't want to talk about it. So often, they've been swindled by somebody in their own family, a nephew, a child, and that just exacerbates that dynamic and makes them even less prone to come forward and talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know while this bill was being debated, critics were charging that billions lost by ordinary Americans in the financial meltdown, let's say, of 2008-2009. Now, this was the result of regulatory failures, predatory lending practices, credit default swaps, all these things completely legal.
Sure.
So it's not the big fish that will be on the offenders list, but the small fries. Any truth to that?
Well, to me, I don't categorize people who've swindled hundreds of millions of dollars from their friends and neighbors as small fries, maybe in relation to, sort of multi-billion dollar economic effects from the phenomenon that you described, perhaps so. But for the people that I've dealt with, the victims, whether the scams or schemes have been a few million dollars or hundreds of million dollars, it doesn't really matter to them. They've lost their entire life savings, their nest egg, and are so vulnerable. This bill's not intended to address all of the ills and all of the inefficiencies, regulatory or otherwise. But if it saves one family or helps protect one couple, then I think it's worth it. The cost is minimal. It allows people to get information, again, that's already public. It's not that we're unearthing and branding people with a scarlet A. This is their burden to bear already. We're just allowing people to access that in a more user-friendly way. Mm-hmm. And one final thing I might add, Virginia, when we talked to judges, they said that they would be willing to sentence lesser sentences with a protection like the registry to give the public some sort of safeguard. And if they're reducing the incarceration times, they're lowering costs, and they're also allowing for reintegration at a more rapid rate.
So is being publicly pilloried or shamed an effective deterrent?
It can be. Shaming can be an effective deterrent, depending on how you do it and again, what the purpose is. I think social scientists like Professor Braithwaite, for instance, have talked about positive effects of shaming and then sort of negative aspects or negative types of shaming, and he sort of categorizes them. And shaming for shaming's sake for being not the most effective, but that there can be an element of shaming that is healthy in terms of the victim and also in terms of the perpetrator on the road back to reintegration and recovery and positive, productive participation in society.
Well, Sean Reyes, I appreciate your time so much. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
Well, we can't talk about shame and mortification without bringing up perhaps the ripest time for embarrassment, the adolescent years. Not so long ago, teenage humiliation was confined to school hallways and neighborhood streets. Now, with teenagers living their lives on social media, the parameters and rules have changed. One online trend 16-year-old radio rookie Tamitayo Fagbenle finds disturbing is something she calls slut-shaming, or using photos and videos to turn a girl's private life inside out.
Back in 17th century Puritan times, shaming women like Hester Prynne for their wanton acts was a whole town effort.
Hester Prynne, you have been found guilty of adultery.
I was 10 when I read the Scarlet Letter.
Has she no shame?
Hester was cast out of the community and forced to wear red letter A for adultery.
It would be better if they put the brand of the hot iron on her. That she could not hide.
Slut-shaming like this has been going on for centuries, but now there's a new tool. Instead of shaming hussies in the town square, there are thousands of Facebook and web pages literally called Exposing Hoes. So there's this photo on Facebook of this girl. She's laying down on her bed. She seems to be half naked. All she had on was a white t-shirt. And the boy tagged her in the picture so everybody could go to her page. This picture was put up 43 minutes ago, and it already has 443 likes and 261 comments. People post pictures and videos and make smut lists for their neighborhood or school. I'm just gonna read some of the comments now. Your life is officially shot, LMAO. One boy put, I think she gonna cut her veins when she see this. As for the boy who put up the picture. The boy just actually posted a status. He said he has 2,000 friend requests because of the photo he just put up. And this is like a regular occurrence. Like, I'm sure it's gonna be pulled down. Maybe I should report it right now, but I don't know. 2 years ago, when I was in ninth grade, a girl in my class faced a similar situation. Her boyfriend put an intimate video of them up on the internet. It was the talk of the town.
He was going around holding his head high saying, oh, well, I was able to do this with her, and he gave me a bad name. It was on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, WorldStar, everything.
So WorldStar is like the X-rated version of YouTube.
It was on WorldStar?
It was on everything.
Gets to a social media network, it's over for her life.
Yeah, I think that's wrong, right?
I gathered a group of girls in my school to talk about slut-shaming online.
They be getting exposed, like...
Like yesterday.
Like yesterday, there was some girl, she was in a picture with like a...
penis in her mouth.
Yeah, smiling.
Girls often feel they need to shame other girls for their improper behavior.
Girls do it to themselves. Half the time we came and blame guys. Like, she was literally looking into the camera smiling.
She wasn't smiling.
But it's not always the girl's fault.
There's people that they don't know when they're taking the picture. There's people that don't know they're getting recorded. That's not fair that a guy can actually hide his phone, have sex with you, and record you, and then show it to his friends like, yo, look.
When I was talking to the girl this happened to, she said she didn't know she was being recorded.
I kind of had a feeling that something was wrong, but I didn't want to believe it.
Can you just walk me through the first day you came to school after it happened?
Well, I came to school hoping that it wouldn't be too big of a deal. I was walking around the school with my hood on trying to just, like, to get to class.
But even the principal already knew about the video. He brought her to his office and called her mom.
I went back to class, and like half an hour later, my mother was in the school. And I couldn't even look at my mother because I felt hurt, and I also felt like I disrespected her. And I didn't want kids in the school to look at my mother and be like, wow, she raised nothing.
I see girls get exposed on my Facebook news feed almost every day.
It was about 7th grade, and I'm in 12th grade now.
Back in middle school, this guy emailed a picture of his girlfriend without a shirt on to some of his friends. It spread around their entire school.
Did she transfer out of the school after
it
happened?
She stayed and continued to be the smut, smitty, slide, skip-scap, scallywap, you know, whore.
I don't want to make an assumption because he's a friend of mine, but maybe he doesn't understand the seriousness of what he did.
So did you intend it to be malicious?
I guess I thought it would be cool or something. It took me a day to send it out, and then from a day, it just went around until it finally got back to the school and the teacher saw it.
Schools have had to take on a new role. Some students screenshot the cyberbullying they see online, print it out, and bring it to the teachers as evidence.
Can you tell me your name, please?
My name is Erica Doyle.
Erica is the assistant principal at my school.
In cases where somebody might put up a sexually explicit video, is it necessary for you to contact the authorities?
Yes, absolutely. Because once we're dealing with digital media that is sexually explicit, that has been captured and shared with the public, that actually now is a criminal matter.
I got arrested. They handcuffed me to a bench. That was pretty scary.
But most of the time, the police don't find out. Kids don't usually report it.
You said that when you decided to do it, you thought it would make you cool. So did it make you cool?
Yeah, after it happened, there was a lot of like, yeah, man, that was awesome.
You sound pretty unremorseful right now.
I regret doing it to her, but still, I didn't have to go to jail. Porn websites do it every day, so even the girls gave me props. But there was about like 1% of them that thought I did the wrong thing.
I don't typically do this, but when I saw that photo of the girl lying down on a bed without underwear, I decided to report it to Facebook as harassment.
Okay, so Facebook sent me a notification. It says,
15 minutes later, the photo was still up. Facebook said that it didn't violate their community standards. But their community standards state a strict policy against any explicitly sexual content where a minor is involved.
It now has 500 likes.
So then I reported it as pornographic content. After another 15 minutes, I got a similar message.
Content not removed. What? Why is the content not removed?
I talked to a Facebook spokesperson. She said she can't talk about specific cases, and she refused to go on record about anything to do with the issue.
Don't know what to do. And the photo's still gonna be up there. Before you yourself were affected, what did you think of girls like that? And what do you think now?
Well, I would do the same thing that happened to me. Like, I was calling them names and I was judging them. But then when it happened to me, there were situations like on Facebook where they'd be blowing up some other girl's spot. And I'm like, wow, she screwed up the same way I did.
Teenagers today aren't more cruel than they were in the 1600s. It's just that now when we chastise each other, everybody that has access to the internet can see it. And once that picture or video is out, you can't be completely safe in your mind that the past won't creep up on you at some random time.
I saved the pictures. I know the teachers deleted. I still have them.
This is the new Scarlet Letter.
It is now ordered that you shall wear upon your bosom for the rest of your natural life the Scarlet Letter A.
For WNYC, I'm rookie reporter Temitayo Fagbenle.
Well, we've talked about lives destroyed by public humiliation and our own impulse to cast stones. Now it's time for some mercy. Up next on Word of Mouth, learning to forgive the shamers. But first, a quick break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Our show today has been all about shame, especially public shame, and how quickly and extensively it spreads through today's media environment. We've talked about lives destroyed by humiliation and the role that all of us, as spectators, retweeters, and armchair judges, play in the endless parade of unforgivable deeds. So now we seek some redemption for the shamed and for the shamers. So we've invited Robert Enright. He's a foremost authority on forgiveness to join us. He's founder of the International Forgiveness Institute based in Madison, Wisconsin, where he is professor of educational psychology. And Robert Enright, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's an honor to be here with you, Virginia.
We think of forgiveness mostly as something that one grants to another person. Your work suggests something else.
Well, our work suggests that the idea of forgiving, as opposed to receiving forgiveness, is a very powerful way to heal emotionally from the injustices, such as public shaming, that can occur in a person's life.
But you also say forgiveness is something you do for yourself.
Well, yes, in terms of the outcome of what forgiveness is. Forgiveness itself, actually going back to the time of Aristotle over 2,000 years ago, is a moral virtue, as is justice, patience, kindness, that we give to others for their good. The paradox of forgiveness is that when we have mercy on those who are not being fair to us, we are the ones who are healed emotionally, and we have a lot of scientific evidence to show that.
So what do you think when you're witnessing these public acts of shaming? I'm thinking of a couple of weeks ago, Monica Lewinsky, she gave a TED Talks. Now, this is a full 20 years after becoming the butt of so many jokes, and the first person kind of virally disgraced when the affair she had with the president as a White House intern was described in a lengthy report. She said that she felt disgraced, she felt suicidal, she'd not quite found her way. So what is her work to do? To forgive us? To forgive Clinton herself?
Well, first of all, we have to realize that she's turning the anger that is meant for others onto herself. Because if she thinks that her worth is no longer any good, that she's worthless, or that she's contemplating suicide, she's got a lot of anger, and we have to realize that. And forgiveness centers on this issue of anger. And the question is, at whom is she actually angry? I can't answer that, and you can't answer that, but it surely looks like there are a number of people, including the president, including those who ridiculed her, and including herself if she has broken her own standard. So she definitely has a lot of work to do, and each one of them will be different in how she approaches forgiveness.
Well, then what do you do to forgive millions of people? I mean, the entire American public that passed around the details of this affair with zeal.
Well, I would go to an analogy of racism as an example. I work with a lot of African-American students on the University of Wisconsin campus. I teach a course for the Center of for Educational Opportunity, and they've taught me a lot. They ask me the question, how can you forgive a system? And I said, before I entered into dialogue with them, well, you pick out the particular people who've hurt you, and you forgive them in particular and try to be concrete about it. But they've convinced me that when a norm starts to be established and perpetuated over time, it is by persons, and so we can forgive because forgiveness is centered in not forgiving things or incidents or tornadoes, but persons. Mm-hmm. And we can forgive the group for perpetrating a norm of indifference or hostility. And I think Monica could do the exact same thing. It's more abstract than forgiving one person for a snide comment, and you know who they are and you know what their life is about. But I'm now convinced that you can forgive people who perpetrate norms. And in her case, it's that it's okay, and you and I know it's not okay, to disparage her because of a private act.
Yeah, we know it's not okay, but yet many of us fully participate in this kind of thing. And you know, in many incidences since the Monica Lewinsky incident, we hear about someone being guilty and pass it around. You know, we hear about the cop that shot Walter Scott and we say, oh, look at this guy. He should be humiliated and shamed for what he's done.
Yes. Well, I have a new book actually coming out in August called 8 Keys of Forgiveness. And it's from Norton in New York. And one of the chapters is on the issue of power and power misused. And I come to the conclusion that a lot of people feel in a false sort of way that they're building themselves up by having power over others. But that's where forgiveness comes in, because it checks their power at the door with more of a quiet humility that can stun the world. And it's really almost like a martial art where a person comes at us with power and we respond with mercy and humility. And that can make all the difference in turning that anger away from ourselves and even away from those who've had this unjust power over us, and not only settle myself as a person in a psychological sense, but maybe even settle down those who are drawing some kind of perverse meaning from their use of power over other human beings. Hmm. See, one thing you should realize with regard to forgiveness, it helps train the mind that all people, regardless of circumstances, regardless of culture, have what we call inherent or built-in worth. And it takes time for that to settle into the identity of people who forgive over and over again. But once you get it, once you get the idea that we all have inherent worth, that includes me, who's been shamed, let's say, or Monica, who's been shamed. She says, hey, if the other person has inherent worth, so do I. But then so do those who have perpetrated mayhem against us. And when we struggle to see that they have inherent worth, not because of what they've done, but in spite of that, that's when we start opening ourselves up to the possibilities that even those who shame us are more than their actions of perverse power against us.
Well, it's so interesting that you use the term inherent worth, because reading up on some of your research about forgiveness and injustice, I was reminded of this idea that there is first of all, there's a kind of victimization and holding on to pain and not forgiving. It in a way perpetuates situations, and I think shame, from what we know, can be the same, that if people do shameful things and are shamed, they think, okay, I'm not worth it. I'm just going to continue on this path. It's kind of a spiral. So I'm wondering how a lack of forgiveness plays into this cycle.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Virginia. Those who've been treated badly by others way too often believe the message. And they end up saying, I am now worthless because people are telling me I'm worthless. And what forgiveness does is it reverses that completely. It takes work. It takes a lot of effort. And I use the term building forgiveness muscle, where you begin slowly and with baby steps, seeing that other people who have not hurt you, who are not part of the forgiveness equation, have this inherent worth. And eventually we can apply that to those who have hurt us. And that can take a very long time. As an example, Suzanne Friedman, a professor at the University of Northern Iowa, and I worked with 12 courageous incest survivors. All of them came to us with their self-esteem on the floor. They didn't like themselves because others violated them. And once they realized that they themselves could forgive, and they started out thinking they would never do so, and they were giving this sense of inherent worth to the man who had immense power over her, she or they, all 12 of them, began to see the inherent worth of this man, not because of what he did, but in spite of it, and they all then applied it to themselves so they could stand up again, and they got their lives back. And they were shamed because people whisper about that sort of thing. And one woman was so depressed, she could not take her dream job outside of Madison, Wisconsin. She forgave the man, which might seem astonishing and almost unfair, and she got her life back and took her dream job and left the city for a new life. So the paradox of forgiveness is, even though it seems so unreasonable to offer goodness in the face of power and badness toward you, you get your life back.
Well, I think that's a great place to end on the quality of mercy, no matter how difficult. And Robert Enright, I want to thank you for joining us.
You're quite welcome, Virginia. Take care.
Robert Enright is author of several books about forgiveness and founder of the International Forgiveness Institute in Madison, Wisconsin, where he is also a professor of educational psychology. More about him and the Forgiveness Institute and his books at wordofmouthradio.org. We hope that you've enjoyed today's exploration of the destructive force that is shame. We all have things that we're ashamed of. It's what those secrets drive us to do that's the problem. For his book about public shaming, John Ronson interviewed the psychiatrist James Gilligan, who told him that all violence is an attempt to replace shame with self-esteem. It's a profound thought that shame drives us to more shameful deeds. So we encourage you to break the cycle and let go of it all. Unburden yourself. Make an anonymous confession on Post Secrets. Tell someone you trust. Write it down and bury it. Or as I saw once in a movie, whisper it into a tree. We just don't recommend posting it on Twitter. They'll eat you alive. You can also share this show with others. After all, we help each other out by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.